Scene 9. When expectations get out of control. It's 3 p.m. Paul is back at his desk, trying to plan how he will deliver the new project if he wins it. He agreed to the tight deadline and asked for 2 days to create a detailed project plan before providing a final formal quote. Since the client first contacted him 4 days ago, Paul has been looking forward to working out how much money he could make from this project. He expects a healthy profit, enough to pay for a good vacation and to take his business to another level. The potential windfall has helped generate a positive mood since Paul first thought about it, and he's been chatting with Emily about where they might take a vacation this year with the extra money. He's also pleased he told his contractors about the pitch. He hasn't had much work for them lately, and the news seems to have cheered them up. Paul opens up a spreadsheet to build a proper budget for the project. He puts in the highest fee he thinks he can charge and still be competitive, and works out his general costs. After a few more calculations, he notices he will need to use all his contractors if he's going to write the software in 8 weeks. As he gets close to finishing, he's looking forward to scrolling down the spreadsheet to see how much profit there will be. Finishing his calculations, 10 minutes later, he scrolls down and sees that the profit number is in the negative. Paul isn't too worried at first. He assumes there must be an incorrect formula somewhere, and he goes looking for his error. 20 minutes later, he stares into the kitchen sink, the tap on, watching the water run. He's been standing like this now for more than 2 minutes.
"Dad, there's a drought on, you know," Josh yells from the open fridge door, where he's hunting for a snack.
"Oh, yeah," Paul replies distractedly.
"I'm going to the store. There's nothing here to eat. Can I have some money, please?" Josh asks as he shuts the fridge door.
"No, go do your homework," Paul replies. "And there's plenty of food. We spent a fortune on shopping 2 days ago."
"Dad, what's your problem? You're usually happy to get me out of the house. Don't be such a pain."
"Look," Paul responds, now getting uptight.
"Just do what I say. It's not a good day for me."
"But, Dad, I've arranged to meet a friend."
"Well, tell them your dad is a nasty person and won't let you go."
"Fine." Josh storms off. Moments later, his bedroom door slams. Paul goes back to his office and tries to think. He can't put the price up, so he will either have to let the project go or find a cheaper way of delivering it than through his usual suppliers. Neither option makes any sense right now. A wave of depression washes over him. Irrelevant tasks soon distract him, things his assistant should be doing, opening envelopes and filing papers. He wants to do something to take his mind off feeling so glum, so he starts writing a note to his suppliers about the job not going ahead for now. As he writes, a quiet alert signal about emailing such a note almost makes it into his awareness, but like a cell phone at a loud party, the signal is too quiet to be noticed. He presses send. Moments later, a reply arrives from a long-term supplier, Ned. Ned claims Paul is being blinded by the money. Paul shoots an angry email back. 30 minutes later, while Paul is replying to another angry email from a different supplier, Michelle gets back from school. She asks her father about his day, and they talk about what happened. Michelle is only 3 years older than Josh, but seems a decade more mature.
"Dad, why don't you just find someone overseas to do the coding for you? That's what people do nowadays," she suggests.
"Thanks for the thought, sweetie, but I don't know anyone I could trust. Plus, I'd have to go overseas myself, and there's no time to do any of that."
"Maybe there's another way," Michelle says, as she wanders off to the kitchen. She finds ingredients for a sandwich and makes them both a snack.
They go to the back porch to eat. Paul asks Michelle more about her day. Michelle got better marks on an art project than she had expected. Paul gets interested in what she's doing, wondering whether she might be talented. For a moment, he pictures himself back at school working on a science project, excited about learning. An idea bursts onto his stage. He might be able to find a supplier who arranges software programming for small consultants like him. He goes back to his desk to search for suppliers online.
Within a short time, he has sent inquiries to three companies that appear reputable and already has one response back. He starts to feel better already. The fog of depression lifts, leaving a slight haze of possible good news in its stead. If only he hadn't made such a mess of things. In under an hour, Paul has managed to harm some important relationships with both his son and his long-term suppliers. He'll be able to mend his relationship with Josh as soon as tonight, but Ned may not be so forgiving. It didn't have to be this way. With a little knowledge about his brain, Paul could have reached his insight about offshoring without the collateral damage. Paul needs to know how to stay cool under pressure in a new way. He needs to learn to manage his expectations, in particular, the expectations of positive rewards. What to expect from an expectation? Up until now in this act, we focused on managing the threat response, because it's more common and stronger than the reward response. And who needs to learn how to handle the emotions that result from a good meal or great conversation? However, positive situations can sometimes send you off kilter, too. In a game of poker, if you're dealt a pair of aces, the best possible cards you can get, it's easy to get overexcited about winning the hand. This excitement about potentially winning creates a lot of arousal in your limbic system. While this high level of arousal might feel pleasant, the outcome is similar to negative arousal. There are fewer resources available for your stage, so you don't think as clearly. The result is you miss ways that you could still lose that normally you would easily notice. Mistakes made this way, both at the poker table and in life, can be expensive. Paul's situation in this scene is like that of expecting to win with a pair of aces. It's not an actual positive reward that's thrown him here. It's the expectation of a reward. The expectation of a positive reward has quite an impact on the brain, changing not just your ability to process information, but even what and how you perceive. Expectations are also central in the creation of upward and downward spirals in the brain. They can take you to the peak of performance or to the depths of despair. Maintaining the right expectations in life may be central for maintaining a general feeling of happiness and well-being. Creating just the right expectations is also an opportunity for your director to write the emotional script of your daily life rather than only reacting to challenges as they arise. What you expect is what you experience. An expectation is an unusual construct, as it's not an actual reward, but rather a feeling of a possible reward. Whether you're seeing a delicious berry in real life, or on your mental stage, or just expecting to see one, in each case the map for berry is activated, as is your reward circuitry. Positive expectations are all about sensing that an event or item of value is heading your way. Value in the brain, of course, means something that will help you survive. Primary rewards, such as sugary foods and sex, are generally tagged as valuable by the limbic system. You can also create your own maps for items or experiences that you decide are of value. You could choose to value good quality shoes. In this case, like Carrie in Sex and the City, just walking past a shoe store might make you happy. In Paul's case, he has created a map of billions of interconnected neurons that represents the potential profit from this project. This map has become denser because he has thought about it, paid attention to it, and even talked about it, in this case to his wife in relation to a vacation. Another example of a self-created map for something of value is when you set a goal. When you set a goal, you make a decision that an end result is of value. As you think about this goal or work toward it, you increase the expectations of a reward. Heading toward a goal can activate an overall toward state in the brain. Your brain automatically orients toward events, people, and information that connects to what you have valued positively. In a paper called The Neuroscience of Goal Pursuit, Elliot Berkman and Matthew Lieberman explained that Participants in several social psychological studies have been shown to orient toward goal cues and engage in goal pursuit while being completely unaware of both actions. That's why, when I decided to have children, I started to notice carriages, playgrounds, and kids' menus everywhere. This principle has been studied right down to the neuronal level. Scientists have trained monkeys to expect to see a specific object, say a red triangle. Neurons in the monkey's brain for perceiving a red triangle light up before the triangle appears. The phrase, "seek and you shall find," may have a basis in neuroscience. Because expectations alter perception, this leads people to see what they expect to see and not see what they're not expecting. When Paul's spreadsheet does not meet his expectations, he discards the data, assuming an error has been made. Josh thinks there's no food in the house, and therefore doesn't notice opportunities for snacks. Michelle doesn't have that expectation and sees a different world in the same refrigerator. Unmet expectations often create a threat response, which I explain further later in this scene. Because the brain is built to avoid threat, people tend to work hard to reinterpret events to meet their expectations. It's all too common to see people make tenuous links between ideas that are not really linked, or discard important data that might disprove a theory. This sometimes comes with tragic results, from police officers accidentally shooting someone they expect to be armed, to one country invading another nation based on assumptions that later prove incorrect. This won't hurt a bit. Some scientists believe that expectations can explain the placebo effect. In one study by Dr. Don Price, three groups of volunteers with irritable bowel syndrome, who were fully informed of what was to come, and, it is hoped, well paid, had a balloon blown up in their rectums. They were asked to rate the pain on a scale of 1 to 10. One group experienced the pain with no medication, with an average pain rating of 5.5 out of 10. Another group was given lidocaine, a local anesthetic that removes most feeling. This group experienced an average pain rating of 2.5 out of 10. Another group was given a placebo, nothing but Vaseline, and was told they were probably given a placebo. They experienced an average pain rating of 3.5 out of 10. The placebo lessened perceived pain, even when people were told they may have been given a placebo. Price repeated the experiment, but this time the placebo group was told they had been given something known to powerfully reduce pain in most people. They weren't told they'd been given a placebo, but they were not lied to either, as placebos do reduce pain in some people. What Price did was mess with people's expectations. This group experienced even less pain than those given the lidocaine. This kind of study has been repeated many different ways now, and over again we see that messing with people's expectations can have a remarkable effect on their perception. Professor Robert Coghill, a pain researcher at the University of Florida, designed an experiment in which people experienced intense pain on the leg via a calibrated heat pad. He then played with people's expectations to see what impact this might have on how they rated their pain. 10 out of 10 of our subjects had pain ratings go down when they simply just expected they were going to get a 48 degrees Celsius rather than 50 degrees Celsius stimulus, Coghill explains. In a paper called The Subjective Experience of Pain, Where Expectations Become Reality, Coghill added, "Positive expectations produce a reduction in perceived pain that rivals the effects of a clearly analgesic dose of morphine." The right dose of expectations can be as powerful as the one of the strongest painkillers. Dr. Bruce Lipton's book, The Biology of Belief, explores this phenomenon in more detail. Coghill wanted to know if the placebo effect involved fooling yourself. Was it just a mind thing, or were there real changes in the brain? He looked at brain scans of people experiencing reduced pain through altered expectations. He found that when people expect a moderate level of pain, but instead get a strong level, it changes the brain regions normally responsive to pain. We get dramatically reduced activation of a host of brain regions, Coghill explains. Expect something good or bad, and it impacts the activation of brain regions the same as the actual experience would when generated in reality. The neurochemistry of underpromising. Expectations don't just affect the data you perceive and change the activation of brain regions. They also have a strong impact on your neurochemistry. The best research for this comes from Professor Wolfram Schulz at Cambridge University in England. Schulz studies the links between dopamine and the reward circuitry. Dopamine cells sit deep within the brain, in the midbrain, connecting from there to neurons in the nucleus accumbens, and fire off in anticipation of primary rewards. Schulz found that when a cue from the environment indicates you're going to get a reward, dopamine is released in response. Unexpected rewards release more dopamine than expected ones. Thus, the surprise bonus at work, even a small one, can positively impact your brain chemistry more than an expected pay raise. However, if you're expecting a reward and you don't get it, dopamine levels fall steeply. This feeling is not a pleasant one. It feels a lot like pain. Expecting a pay raise and not getting one can create a funk that lasts for days. However, low levels of unmet expectations are something we all experience constantly. Expect the stoplight to change and find it taking a long time, and your dopamine level falls, leaving you feeling frustrated. Expect the service at the bank to be fast, but find a long queue, more frustration. Not only does dopamine go down in these instances, it also generates an away response, reducing prefrontal functioning. You might need to reappraise, perhaps saying to yourself, "This is good motivation to set up my internet banking." Do this, and you will find frustration dissipating and a toward response taking its place. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter of desire. Dopamine levels rise when you want something, even something as simple as to cross the road. Dopamine is a driver of the reward response in most of the animal kingdom, too. At last, we know the real reason the chicken wanted to cross the road. It was craving a burst of dopamine. Put simply, dopamine is central to the toward state, to being open, curious, and interested. It is even tied to the act of movement itself. Parkinson's patients, having lost most of their dopamine neurons, have trouble initiating movement. The number of connections made per second in the brain is also tied to dopamine levels. A hit of cocaine dramatically increases dopamine levels, with people chaotically jumping from idea to idea as the number of connections per second increases. When dopamine levels are too low, the number of connections per second in the brain falls. The movie Awakenings with Robin Williams and Robert De Niro illustrates the story of a patient who goes from comatose to manic after being given a dopamine-producing agent, L-DOPA. When the L-DOPA is stopped, the patient plummets back into a comatose state. The dopamine cells in the nucleus accumbens connect to many parts of the brain, including the prefrontal cortex, where the right levels of dopamine are critical for focusing, as we learned in Act 1. According to Amy Arnston, you need a good level of dopamine to hold an idea in your prefrontal cortex. Positive expectations increase the level of dopamine in the brain, and this increased level makes you more able to focus. This makes sense intuitively. Teachers know that kids learn best when they're interested in a subject. Interest, desire, and positive expectations are slight variations on a similar experience, the experience of having an increased level of dopamine in the brain. Paul's dopamine level plummeted when his profit expectations were not met. He experienced a sudden reduction in desire to do anything significant. He wanted to do mundane tasks that his assistant should have been doing. He also experienced a drop in the number of ideas his brain processed per minute and reduced overall activation of his brain. His brain was in an overall away emotional state, which made it harder for him to think about complex problems such as outsourcing his coding. Josh experienced a similar challenge. He was anticipating the reward of seeing a friend, and when his father thwarted his plan, he became upset and angry. In Paul's reduced dopamine state, he struggled to think through his situation. The project looked hopeless. He was starting on a downward spiral, where a low dopamine level can lead to an even lower dopamine level. It wasn't until he became interested in something, in his daughter's day at school, that his dopamine level rose to a point where he could start experiencing a toward response. Then, when he had his own insight about outsourcing, he became excited and was off again taking action. The unexpected insight increased his dopamine level. Each positive new connection he made, finding possible suppliers, for example, increased his anticipation of further rewards, increasing his ability to make new connections. He had shifted into an upward spiral. Michelle also found herself in an upward spiral in this scene. She was already in a positive state of mind, and when her grade for her artwork was better than expected, her mood improved even more. This upward spiral allowed her to see a possible solution to her dad's challenge, where he could see only problems. She even saw more options for food in the fridge than Josh had. This upward spiral sounds suspiciously like it might partly explain why people perform better when they're happy. Lots of research has been done, such as by Barbara Fredrickson from the University of North Carolina, showing that happy people perceive a wider range of data, solve more problems, and come up with more new ideas for actions to take in a situation. The link between expectations, dopamine, and perception may explain why happiness is a great state for mental performance. Perhaps the elusive search for happiness is actually a search for the right level of dopamine. From this perspective, to create a happy life, perhaps you should live a life with a good amount of novelty, create opportunities for unexpected rewards, and believe that things are always going to get slightly better. Creating the right expectations. Whether your goal is to be eternally happy or just to improve your performance at work, clearly it's going to be useful to manage expectations well, to create the right level of dopamine. To be clear, I'm not an advocate of consuming L-DOPA, cocaine, or any other substance that induces a greater dopamine level. The best way to manage your expectations, without any side effects, is to start to pay attention to them, which means activating your director. Managing your expectations is also an opportunity for your director to be more proactive, setting the scene for good performance rather than just sorting out problems when things go wrong. Unmet expectations are one of the most important experiences to avoid, as these generate the stronger threat response. With any brain function, the important thing is firstly to minimize threat, explains Evian Gordon. Only once threat has been minimized can you focus on increasing possible rewards. Great leaders carefully manage expectations to avoid not meeting them. When Barack Obama was sworn in as the new U.S. president in 2009, he took care to ensure that people reduced their expectations both of him and the years ahead. Consciously altering what you expect can have a surprising impact. Imagine you're trying to get an upgrade for a long international flight. If you keep your expectations low, you'll either be okay if you don't get the reward or thrilled if you do. Whereas, if you allow yourself to get excited about the possible upgrade, you'll either have a terrible flight if you don't get it, or be only quietly happy, though not thrilled if you do get it. When you step back and look at all the possible outcomes this way, it makes sense to minimize one's expectations of positive rewards in most situations. Keeping an even keel about potential wins pays off. As well as making sure you keep your expectations low, another way to boost your mood is to pay additional attention to positive expectations you know will be met for sure. A colleague recently said, "I like to use the fact that I have a holiday coming up, even if it's months away, to help me be positive. If I focus on this, though it's not logical, I have learned this helps keep the doldrums away. Choosing to focus on things always getting a little bit better, even with evidence at times to the contrary, helps you maintain a good level of dopamine." Great athletes know how to manage their expectations. They don't get overexcited about possibly winning, as this ruins their concentration. And if they're worried about losing, they try not to expect that either. Managing your expectations in any way requires, as with labeling and reappraisal, a strong director. When you can stop and notice your own mental state, you have the capacity to make choices about different ways of thinking. Great athletes observe the flow of their attention and make subtle changes to where their attention goes. Their director might notice expectations getting too aroused and choose to dampen excitement, pushing the brain to stay focused on the moment instead. To use your director well, you need to be able to find it. One of the best techniques for this is simply to pay more attention to your own experience, including watching how expectations alter your state of mind. Let's look at what Paul might have done differently here if he had had a strong director and had been able to manage his expectations, even in his challenging situation. When expectations get out of control, take two. It's 3 p.m. Paul is back at his desk thinking about how he's going to deliver the new project. He agreed to the tight deadline, but asked for 2 days to create a detailed project plan. He goes to open a spreadsheet, then stops to think about his mental process. He doesn't feel that he's in the right state of mind for this kind of work. He doesn't know why just yet, but a quiet signal is telling him to think about how to approach this budgeting task. He decides to take a brief walk to the store to get some milk, knowing he will have time to reflect along the way. On his walk, he remembers how excited he has been in the past about good profits, and how this excitement got in the way of clear thinking. He pushes aside the urge to get excited about the project, deciding not to give the thought any attention. He was just about to call a few of his suppliers to share the good news, but decided this might not be a good idea in case expectations are not met. Paul's director can pull back the wrong actors just as they're about to go on stage, which is the easiest time to stop them. Paul returns home and opens a spreadsheet to cost out the project. He works out that he'll need all of his contractors and that they'll have to work more hours than usual. They will charge him extra, as they will have to put more staff on his project. He plugs in the numbers and scrolls down to see the profit figure at the bottom. It's in the negative. Paul knows he could get upset by this, but he vetoes his attention going down that path, telling himself he knows this is a first attempt at the pricing. There are probably ideas he hasn't thought of. He gets up and goes to the kitchen to get a snack, thinking that some glucose might help him make new connections. Josh comes in to look for food, and Paul uses the opportunity to explain his challenge, hoping that another perspective might help get around an accidental impasse. As he hears himself explaining the challenge out loud to Josh, he has an idea. The insight pops into his mind as he talks about there being no other way of doing this job with a profit. His director, observing his sensation as he said these words, realized how silly the words sounded. There's always another way. Speaking aloud about complex ideas can be a way of seeing your own thinking more clearly. Paul sees that this could be a great chance to try outsourcing his coding to someone in a cheaper country. In his more positive state, Paul maintains an open mind about the idea. He doesn't resist it, even though the idea is uncertain. A small amount of uncertainty is easier to take when you're in a torrid state. Paul searches the web for software suppliers in India and finds many. He gets a quick and positive response from a possible supplier. When Josh asks about going to the store to buy a snack, Paul asks his son about his homework, which he's pleasantly surprised to learn Josh has already done. In his happy state, Paul gives Josh some money and watches as he bounds out the door, happy to be seeing a friend as expected. When Michelle comes home, they chat about her successful day at school. Paul gives her positive feedback that leaves her beaming. She offers to cook dinner for everyone, and Paul says he will get takeout instead so they have more time to hang out together. It's been a great day. A final word on Act Two. As we wrap up the second act, you now have three specific techniques for staying cool under pressure. Each of them requires activating your director and getting focused on the present, which will increase the space on your stage. For average emotional hits, you can try labeling your emotions, which increases a sense of certainty and reduces limbic arousal. For stronger emotional hits, you can reappraise by changing your interpretation of events. This can increase both certainty and autonomy while having a stronger dampening effect. And to help reduce future bursts of arousal, you can manage your expectations by being aware of what they are and choosing new expectations in their place. Each of these techniques is improved by your having a strong director, and each of them builds your director further as you execute them. With these three techniques in hand, or rather easily accessible as maps in your brain, you have a great chance of staying cool under pressure, even in the most difficult of circumstances. Surprises about the brain. Expectations are the experience of the brain paying attention to a possible reward or threat. Expectations alter the data your brain perceives. It's common to fit incoming data into expectations and to ignore data that don't fit. Expectations can change brain functioning. The right dose of expectations can be similar to a clinical dose of morphine. Expectations activate the dopamine circuitry, central for thinking and learning. Met-expectations generate a slight increase in dopamine and a slight reward response. Exceeded expectations generate a strong increase in dopamine and a strong reward response. Unmet expectations generate a large drop in dopamine level and a strong threat response. The dynamic between expectations altering experience and impacting dopamine levels helps generate an upward or downward spiral in the brain. A general feeling of expecting good things generates a healthy level of dopamine and may be the neurochemical marker of feeling happy. Some things to try. Practice noticing what your expectations are in any given situation. Practice setting expectations a little lower. To stay in a positive state of mind, find ways to keep coming out ahead of your expectations over and again, even in small ways. When a positive expectation is not being met, practice reappraising the situation by remembering it's your brain doing something odd with dopamine. Act 3. Collaborate with others. Few people work in isolation anymore. The capacity to collaborate well with others has become central to good performance in just about any endeavor. Yet the social world is also the source of tremendous conflict, and many people never master its seemingly chaotic rules. The problems that occur between people could be reduced if there were a wider understanding of some of the basic needs of the brain. Along with the need for food, water, shelter, and a sense of certainty, there are social needs, which, if not met, create a sense of threat that can quickly devolve into conflicts between people. In Act 3, Emily discovers just how much the brain needs social connections and recognizes the surprising importance of feeling safe among friends. Paul discovers that a sense of fairness drives a lot of behavior and learns to keep this under control in himself and a colleague. Emily finds out that a sense of status is a far bigger need than she ever expected and discovers sustainable ways of increasing her own status without other people feeling threatened. Scene 10. Turning enemies into friends. It's 2 p.m. Emily has just finished getting the sustainability conference approved at lunch. Now, back at her office, she picks up the phone and dials a sequence of numbers from long-term memory. She joins a conference call with her team just in time. Without the need to find the number consciously, Emily conserves her attention and uses a moment to focus on the present, to reflect, and to activate her director. She notices it takes longer to bring an idea onto her stage than it did several hours ago. She tries to find a word for her state of mind and comes up with frazzled. Naming her state calms her down. She also notices a nagging discomfort in the back of her mind, but can't quite name it. All of this thinking happens in the few seconds as she waits for the recorded message from the conference call system to roll through. Colin and Lisa are on the line when she connects. They abruptly end a conversation as Emily joins in, which leaves an uncomfortable silence. The three of them used to be peers, often working on a conference together till late at night. Emily wonders what it will be like to manage her old buddies, and she senses her anxiety rising. She tries to find a way to reappraise the situation, but doesn't have the focus, and moments later she's distracted further by Joanne, whom she hired this morning, arriving on the line. Emily tries to get her thoughts together by focusing on being organized. She presents the agenda, to decide who will run the sustainability conference, to introduce Joanne, and to plan how the team will meet regularly. She hopes she'll be able to generate a feeling of their all being a team, the sense of community she felt when she managed a group of people working on a previous conference. Yet, with everyone spread across the country, they will rarely meet in person, and everyone has their own conferences to focus on. Emily also briefly worries about introducing a new person to the group when there's a feeling of competition already. This quiet alert signal tries to make itself heard, but fails to gain much attention. "Everyone, I want to introduce you to Joanne, who's taking over the conferences I used to run," Emily says without pausing for air. "I chose her because she's run other large conferences successfully." She thinks she hears Lisa sigh, but she isn't sure. "Nice to meet you all," Joanne responds, and then it's back to the agenda. Emily says she wants to choose someone to run the sustainability conference, and the line goes silent. "Colin," Emily says, "you've worked with me the longest. Who do you think would be best for the job?" Colin and Lisa have never gotten along, but Emily is still surprised by what happens next. "I don't think Lisa is right for a new event," Colin says, as she loves beautifully organized systems rather than complexity. He tries to inject humor into his tone, but he's the only one laughing. Colin continues, unaware of the sharp rise in arousal in Lisa's limbic system. "And it wouldn't be right to put a new person on to this summit. It's a big event." "Not to be rude," Joanne interrupts, "but, Colin, this is the same size event as the ones I used to do." "Colin," Lisa jumps in, "you're not the best person when it comes to managing numbers yourself." Colin knows Lisa is harking back to a conference that lost money. "Lisa, don't attack Colin on my behalf," Joanne responds. "I'm just saying that I've run big events, so don't count me out." Emily tries to bring the focus back to the conference, but it's hopeless. Under their polished surface, Colin and Lisa are like two alley cats hissing at each other. Emily decides to close the meeting early, hoping she can sort this out with the team one-on-one. Emily is disappointed. She can't understand why everyone has behaved this way. She's especially annoyed at Colin, whom she thought she could trust. He should know better than to bring a new person into the fold with such a negative experience, she thinks to herself. Doesn't he appreciate how hard it is to find good people? This intense emotional experience has burned a strong memory in Emily's hippocampus and amygdala. When she sees or thinks of Colin in the future, she will remember this conference call. She makes a mental note to treat Colin differently from the friend she thought he was. She then thinks about Joanne, wondering if she might decide not to take the job after all. This thought generates a lot of uncertainty, making Emily feel even worse. It's been a difficult and confusing half hour. Success in most jobs today requires a strong ability to collaborate with others. For some people who build their mental maps around logical systems such as computers or engineering, the chaos and uncertainty of dealing with people can be overwhelming. But it turns out there are rules to successful engagements in the social world. One of the big rules being uncovered is that the social world is deeply important to our moment-to-moment existence. As Matthew Lieberman says, 4 out of 5 processes operating in the background when your brain is at rest involve thinking about other people and yourself. Emily has been blindsided by the brain's social nature. She doesn't know how closely attuned the limbic system is to the social environment, or how easy it is for people to misread social cues. In the absence of positive social cues, it's easy for people to fall back into the more common mode of human interactions, distrusting others. In this brain state, with the limbic system overly activated, a joke becomes a slight. A slight becomes an attack, and an attack becomes a battle. And that can be the end of productive, goal-focused thinking for as long as humans can hold a grudge, which is a long time indeed. Emily knows the rules that underpin how to run successful conferences. These involve managing budgets, suppliers, advertising, and systems. Like a classical musician learning jazz, Emily needs to learn new rules for successfully collaborating with others. In this scene, she needs to become better at turning enemies into friends. The brain is a social animal. If you were a wolf, large parts of your brain would be devoted to getting resources directly from the wild. You would have complex maps for interacting with the physical landscape, maps for sniffing out a distant meal, and others for finding your way home in the dark. As a human, especially when young, you get your resources not from the wild, but from other people. Because of this, large amounts of human cortical real estate is devoted to the social world. If you work in an office, you could probably close your eyes and describe 10 people around you, how important they are in relation to one another and to you, how they feel today, whether they can be trusted, and how many favors any of them might owe you. Your memories of your social interconnections are vast. Social neuroscientists think of the human brain as having a social network, responsible for all your interactions with your social world, similar to other networks you have for seeing, moving, or hearing. The social brain network allows you to understand and connect with others, and to understand and control yourself. It involves regions already discussed in this audiobook, including the medial prefrontal cortex, the right and left ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, and the anterior cingulate cortex, the insula, and the amygdala. This social network is something we're born with. Newborn babies orient toward a picture of a face above any other picture when just a few minutes old. At 6 months, well before they can speak, infants experience advanced socially oriented emotions, such as jealousy. All of this means that social issues matter to the brain, a lot. In fact, some scientists now believe that social needs are in the category of primary threats and primary rewards, as essential for survival as food and water. In the 1960s, Abraham Maslow developed the now famous hierarchy of needs, which shows that humans have an order in which their needs have to be met, starting with physical survival and moving up the ladder all the way to self-actualization. Social needs sit in the middle, but Maslow may have been wrong. Many studies are now showing that the brain interacts with social needs using the same networks as it uses for basic survival. Being hungry and being ostracized activate similar threat and pain responses using the same networks. In this first of three scenes about the social world, Emily has run into the need for feeling safety with others, a fundamental desire to feel related and connected to the people around her. A feeling of relatedness is a primary reward for the brain, and an absence of relatedness generates a primary threat. A sense of relatedness is what you get when you feel that you belong in a group, when you feel part of a cohesive team. Emily used to experience relatedness when she ran the conferences herself, but it's not there in her team now. Mirrors in the brain. The way the brain creates a sensation of connection and relatedness with others involves a surprising discovery about the brain made only in 1995. Emily's conference call went wrong because people made mistakes about the mental state of the others on the call. It began with Colin's attempt at humor being misunderstood. He made a joke that in a face-to-face encounter would have sparked laughter. Without his face and body language visible, everyone misread his intent. People on the call were not connecting the way the brain is best at connecting, which involves being able to copy other people's emotional states and intents directly. The way the brain does this is through mirror neurons. Discovered by Italian neuroscientist Giacomo Rizzolatti at the University of Parma, mirror neurons have opened up a rich new understanding of how human beings connect with others. Rizzolatti discovered that mirror neurons throughout the brain light up when we see other people do what is called an intentional action. If you see someone pick up a piece of fruit to eat, mirror neurons in your brain will light up. These same mirror neurons light up when you eat a piece of fruit yourself. One of the unusual aspects of these neurons is that they light up only if we see someone perform an action that has a specific intent behind it. Random actions don't have the same effect. In this way, mirror neurons seem to be the brain's mechanisms for understanding other people's intent, their goals and objectives, and as a result, feeling connected to them. Christian Kaesers, a leading mirror neuron researcher based in Holland, says, "Our brain seems to make sense of other people through shared circuits. When you witness someone else taking an action, it activates the same circuits in your motor cortex. Someone picks up a glass, your brain does the same. It's through this capacity that you get this intuitive understanding of other people's goals." Research into autism by Marilla DiPreto at UCLA has yielded further clues to the importance of mirror neurons. People with autism are considered mind-blind. They don't accurately decipher what other people are thinking, feeling, or intending, which results in social blunders. Many scientists now think mirror neurons are connected to autism, and new studies do indeed show damage to mirror neurons in this situation. Kaesers explains the way mirror neurons provide a direct experience of another person's intent. What happens is that when we witness others' facial expressions, we activate the same in our own motor cortex, but we also transmit this information to the insula involved in our emotions. When I see your facial expression, I get the movement of your face, which drives the same motor response on my face, so a smile gets a smile. The motor resonance is also sent on to your own emotional centers, so you share the emotion of the person in front of you. Here's the source of Emily's challenge. On the conference call, without faces to see, the group couldn't read one another's emotions. The more social cues that are stripped out of communication, the greater the likelihood that intent will be misread. Most of us have experienced the difficulty of an email being misunderstood, of words being taken out of context. The more we can see each other, the better we can match emotional states, Marco Iacoboni, a UCLA-based mirror neuron researcher, explains. Real interaction activates more than video, which activates more than telephone, as we are reacting to visual input of body language, and especially facial expressions. If people don't have social cues to pay attention to, they can't connect with other people's emotional state. Studies show that the opposite is true, too. An abundance of social cues makes people connect more richly, perhaps in challenging ways at times. For example, when there's an abundance of social cues, emotional information can travel swiftly between people in a type of contagion. Studies show that the strongest emotion in a team can ripple out and drive everyone to resonate with the same emotion without anyone consciously knowing this is happening. The strong emotion gets attention, and what people pay attention to will activate their mirror neurons. In a similar way, the boss's emotions can have a flow-on effect to others, since people pay so much attention to the boss. You see the boss smile, and your brain starts to mimic the smile. Then you smile. Then the boss smiles back. It's a virtuous and upward cycle, with each person raising the depth of the other's smile through a mirroring function. Mirror neurons explain why leaders need to be extra conscious of managing their stress levels, as their emotions really do impact others. On the conference call, the strongest emotion was Lisa getting upset. This created a similar experience for the others on the call. While seeing faces will help the brain mirror others' brain states, mirror neurons can also work without seeing a face, through auditory cues, especially for the stronger away emotional states, which are often easier to arouse. Christian Kaiser says, "If you want to collaborate well with others, you have to understand what kind of state others are in. Mirror neurons are the brain's way of knowing what other people are intending and what they are feeling. They help you determine what your response should be to that person, whether to collaborate or cause trouble." Friend or foe? While collaboration is increasingly important in our ever more connected world, working against this is the rise of the silo mentality, where people collaborate within their own division, unit, or team inside a larger group, but don't share information more widely. It may help to understand that this is just human nature. People naturally tend to form safe tribes with close colleagues and work well within these, and avoid people they don't know well. That's because collaborating with people you don't know well is a threat for the brain. Perhaps, after millions of years living in small groups, the automatic response to strangers is, don't trust them. In a world of scant resources, where people lived only to an average age of 20, this survival strategy worked. Now this reaction may be unnecessary, perhaps even a burden, especially inside organizations that depend on teams of people who should be deeply interconnected. Here's one big reason collaboration is difficult. Just as the brain automatically classifies any situation into a possible reward or threat, it does the same with people, determining subconsciously whether each person you meet is either a friend or foe. Is he someone you want to spend more time with, walk toward if you see him on the street, or stay away from, cross the road if we see him coming? And here's the rub. People you don't know tend to be classified as foe until proven otherwise. This gets to the heart of Emily's challenge during the conference call. Not only did people misunderstand one another, but there was a strong sense of the others being a threat. Being foes, not friends. Friend. You use one set of brain circuits for thinking about people who you believe are like you, who you feel are friends, and a different set for those whom you view as different from you, as foes. When your brain decides someone is a friend, you process your interactions using a similar part of the brain you use for thinking about your own experience. Deciding someone is a friend also generates a toward emotional response, which provides more space on your stage for new ideas. When you interconnect your thoughts, emotions, and goals with other people, you release oxytocin, a pleasurable chemical. It's the same chemical experience that a small child gets when he makes physical contact with his mother, from the moment of birth onward. Oxytocin is released when two people dance together, play music together, or engage in a collaborative conversation. It's the neurochemistry of safe connectivity. In a paper published in Nature in June 2005, a group of scientists found that giving people a spray containing oxytocin increased their level of trust. The paper reports that in non-human mammals, oxytocin receptors are distributed in various brain regions associated with behavior, including pair bonding, maternal care, sexual behavior, and normal social attachments. Thus, oxytocin seems to permit animals to overcome their natural avoidance of proximity and thereby facilitates approach behavior. Our animal instincts seem to naturally cause us to withdraw and treat others as foes unless a situation arises that generates oxytocin. This phenomenon makes sense. It explains why facilitators and trainers insist on icebreakers at the start of workshops, and why established rapport is the first step in any counseling, customer service, or sales training manual. Research within the positive psychology field shows there's only one experience in life that increases happiness over a long time. It's not money, above a base survival amount. It's not health, nor is it marriage or having children. The one thing that makes people happy is the quality and quantity of their social connections. Daniel Kahneman from Princeton University did a study in which he asked women what they most liked to do. Surprisingly, connecting with friends was at the top of the list, above being with their partners or children. The brain thrives in an environment of quality social connections, of safe relatedness. Happiness is not just a good dose of dopamine, but a nice oxytocin buzz, too. Friends with benefits. Having many positive social connections doesn't just increase your happiness. It can also help you perform on the job and even live longer. John T. Cacioppo, a professor at the University of Chicago, studies the way human beings function socially and the impact the social world has on brain functioning. He led a study of 229 people between 50 and 68 years old, finding a 30-point difference in blood pressure between those who experienced loneliness and those with healthy social connections. Loneliness, the study showed, could significantly increase the risk of death from stroke and heart disease. As Cacioppo tried to understand the data, he realized that loneliness might be more important than society generally realizes. Loneliness generates a threat response, Cacioppo explains, the same as pain, thirst, hunger, or fear. Being connected to others in a positive way, feeling a sense of relatedness, is a basic need for human beings, similar to eating and drinking. For those of you who think that hell is other people, remember that social isolation is not the brain's desired state. Having friends around you reduces a deeply ingrained biological threat response. Naomi Eisenberger, a social neuroscientist at UCLA, finds in her studies that increased social support also serves as a buffer against potential stresses by reducing reactivity to other threats. I found that the greater levels of social support people said they had, the less sensitive they were to things like rejection. Eisenberger explains, they seemed to be less stress-responsive. They even produced less cortisol. With less threat, people with good social support networks have more resources for their stage, for thinking, planning, and regulating their emotions, for example. Surrounding yourself with friends not only helps you think better, it also enables you to see situations from novel perspectives by looking through other people's eyes. Friends provide a helping hand for that all-important but cognitively expensive emotional regulation tool, reappraisal. In the same way, having people you trust around can also help bring about insights by broadening thinking and helping you to see your own thinking. This is all much more likely when people see each other as friend, not foe. Having friends helps you change your brain because you get to speak out loud more often. One experiment showed that when people repeated out loud what they were learning, the speed of their learning and their ability to apply that learning to other situations increased. When you speak to someone about an idea, many more parts of your brain are activated than just thinking about the idea, including memory regions, language regions, and motor centers. This is a process called spreading activation. Spreading activation makes it easier to recall ideas later on, as you've left a wider trail of connections to follow. Foe. Recently, I was invited to a party by a friend in New York City. I didn't expect to know anyone there, so I arrived late to be sure my friend would be there. When I arrived and he wasn't there, in theory, I should have felt fantastic. The people at this party looked like the kind of people I would like. It was a beautiful loft. There was good music, nice food, and lots to drink. But I didn't know a soul, and because of that, my threat level was off the charts. To my brain, I had walked into a room full of foes. 5 long minutes of trying to look calm later, my friend arrived, and my threat level went down dramatically. He introduced me to a few people, and I noticed with each new introduction how my threat level decreased. After an hour, I had about 6 groups of people I could talk to, and it ended up being a lovely evening. This situation was a powerful reminder of how big an impact the foe response can have when you're surrounded by even falsely perceived foes. When you sense someone is a foe, all sorts of brain functions change. You don't interact with a perceived foe using the same brain regions you would use to process your own experience. One study showed that when you perceive someone as a competitor, you don't feel empathy with him or her. Less empathy equals less oxytocin, which means a less pleasant sensation of collaboration overall. Thinking someone is a foe can even also make you less smart. Kevin Oxner explains, "Imagine trying to do business with someone who you've had conflict with in the past. Perhaps you keep getting distracted by thoughts of them being attracted to your girlfriend. Thinking of them as an opponent changes how you interact. You're focused on how you interact with them instead of dealing with the business at hand. In this case, your brain is trying to solve 2 different problems, how to deal with a foe and how to do some business. Yet as we know from Act 1, multitasking is difficult. Neither goal is given enough resources and mistakes are made. And mistakes generate yet more threat responses in the brain. When you think someone is a foe, you don't just miss out on feeling his emotions. You also inhibit yourself from considering his ideas, even if they're right. Think of a time you were angry with someone. Was it easy to see things from his perspective? When you decide someone is a foe, you tend to discard his ideas, sometimes to your detriment. Deciding someone is a foe means you make accidental connections, misread intent, get easily upset, and discard their good ideas. In the new team structure with Emily at the helm, Lisa decided during that first call that Colin was a foe. Colin decided that Lisa was a foe. Both Colin and Lisa decided that Joanne was a potential foe, and all of them thought Emily was a foe. And Joanne probably just wanted to get the heck out of there. It's likely this occurred because they were all emotionally charged at the prospect of meeting a new person. Emily's big mistake was not recognizing how critical the social environment is. She didn't know that she needed to diffuse the natural faux state before getting her new team to do some difficult thinking. Going from foe to friend. While this foe response might seem like a scary monster best avoided altogether, it turns out to be easy in most situations to turn things around, provided you're not dealing with a deep foe response, such as a centuries-old ancestral grudge. A handshake, swapping names, and discussing something in common, be it the weather or traffic, can increase feelings of closeness by causing oxytocin to be released. Emily launched straight into her meeting without the chance for people to connect on a human level. Allowing a few minutes for them to get related may have made all the difference. Going from an automatic foe to a friend is not so hard. You probably do it many times a week without noticing. Unfortunately, going from former friend to foe can be all too easy, even after years of positive interactions. This happened between Emily and her old work buddies, now that Emily was the boss and seen as the enemy. Emily also decided not to trust Colin anymore, making a mental note about this after the meeting, yet they had worked well together for years. Because the away emotions, such as being upset with someone, are strong, going from friend to foe can be an intense experience. It's hard enough for Emily's team that they won't meet in person often. What about collaboration between people from different cultures, people unlikely to meet at all? In this case, the automatic foe response might need to be mitigated by dedicating social time in other forms. Perhaps using video to have an informal meeting, or ensuring that people forming teams share personal aspects of themselves via stories, photos, or even social networking sites. Some organizations set up defined buddy systems, or mentoring or coaching programs, all of which foster a sense of relatedness. A study by the Gallup organization showed that companies that encourage water cooler conversations exhibit greater productivity. Increasing the quality and quantity of social connections, up to a point, of course, is likely to improve productivity, as more people find themselves surrounded by fewer foes, first and foremost, and then more friends as well. With all this in mind, it's time for a take two of Emily's conference call. Let's see how differently this could have gone if she had understood the importance of the social world. Turning Enemies into Friends, Take Two. It's 2 p.m. Emily has just finished getting the sustainability conference approved at lunch. Now, back in her office, she picks up the phone and dials a sequence of numbers from her long-term memory. She joins a conference call with her team just in time. She takes a moment to focus and observe her thoughts and internal state to activate her director. She notices it's taking longer now to bring an idea from the audience onto her stage than it did a few hours ago. She tries to find a word for her state of mind and comes up with frazzled. Naming her state calms her down a little, but she also notices there's still something bugging her that she can't quite name. Emily knows how delicate social situations can be, especially when people meet others for the first time. She pauses to pay attention to the issue bugging her, the impasse. She recognizes a pattern buried deep within her limbic system. It's a weak connection that could emerge more clearly if she focuses on it. She puts her phone on mute to buy a moment to focus. In a couple of seconds, an insight materializes. She realizes how important this meeting is, a first one for Joanne, and her first as boss. She senses that she has not done sufficient preparation to ensure that the call go well, and her agenda is wrong. She thinks about the main priority and recognizes that she needs to try to create a feeling of a team with the group before tackling anything hard together. She decides to run a more informal call and not be too ambitious about the conference. She thinks through this scenario, activating billions of circuits in the process in the few seconds her line is on mute, then rejoins the call. She feels more certain now, and has resolved the impasse. Emily's brain is now in an alert but calm state, perfect for noticing subtle signals. Colin and Lisa are on the line already, and they end a conversation as Emily joins the call. She senses an uncomfortable silence. If she hadn't paused and had her insight, she may have reacted badly. "Are you two plotting against me again?" she quips in a funny tone, making everyone laugh. She knows it's important to create connections between them all, as they used to have, working together. Joanne joins the call moments later. Emily explains that there is no formal agenda for the conference call, except for them to get to know one another and talk about how best to work as a virtual team. Emily asks the group for ideas about how they could get to know each other. She wants the group to think about their thinking a little, to activate their own directors. Lisa pipes in, saying it would be good for everyone to introduce themselves and share some of the more successful conferences they've worked on. When Emily first arrived on the line, Lisa and Colin had been talking about how anxious they felt in this new and uncertain team, with an unknown team member joining, and what Emily would be like as a boss. All this contributed to a sense of threat for Lisa and Colin. But by being given the opportunity to come forward with an idea, and then making a choice, Lisa shifted herself into a toward state. Joanne adds an idea to send around photos of themselves with their families. Lisa discovers that Joanne has children the same age as her own, and that the two women obtained the same degree. Lisa reclassifies Joanne as like herself. Conversations with her from now on will be more like speaking to herself, an open channel. Emily goes last. She says she's new to managing people at this level and asks the group what they would like from her. Ideas pour out, with one idea prompting another, and a few themes emerge. People want open communication, trust, and respect. They also want to have fun. The group is resonating, generating good levels of oxytocin. The experience will be tagged as a pleasant one, and they will all look forward to the next call. Colin asks if Emily has sign-off on the new conference. She almost announces that she wants to choose a leader for the sustainability conference, but in her less threatened and quieter mental state, she notices her own fear that the conversation could go wrong at this point. She says she will speak to them individually to get their thoughts, but Colin jumps in and says he thinks Lisa should tackle a big conference, as he was given the last one. Lisa asks Joanne if maybe they could do the event together to get Joanne up to speed faster. The girls agree to collaborate, both knowing how much more fun it can be and how much smarter they feel when they work as a team. The decision is made on the spot, and the group schedules the next meeting to start planning. This second-take scenario and the opening one diverge for the briefest of instants. The positive changes occur with Emily noticing her mental experience, and with her having explicit language for the social world. As she develops this language further, she has an even greater chance of maximizing her performance. Surprises about the brain. Social connections are a primary need, as important as food and water at times. We know one another directly through experiencing other people's states ourselves. Safe connections with others are vital for health and for healthy collaboration. People are classed as friend or foe quickly, with foe as the default in the absence of positive cues. You need to work hard at creating connections to create good collaboration. Some things to try. Anytime you meet someone new, make an effort to connect on a human level as early as possible to reduce the threat response. Become friends with people you work with by sharing personal experiences. Actively encourage people around you to connect on a human level to create better collaboration.